Today's feedback is brought to you by Cufflinks.com. Go to Cufflinks.com/DVR today and use code May40th, and you will get 40% off all officially licensed Star Wars products. May the 4th be with you. That's right, baby, 40% off. Use the code May40th and go to Cufflinks.com/DVR today.
I am Sir Meron Trant, Honorable Knight of the Kingsguard, and I wish to say hello to Sir W. Axel Foley of the DVR Podcast Network and the Podcast Winterfell.
Welcome back to Podcast Winterfell. We have a very special feedback episode for you today. Not only did Justin Thomas and I, Justin Thomas of Top Shelf Phantom, subscribe to him on the YouTube, we did a great little YouTube live stream, had some people in the chat. You can subscribe to us at Podcast Winterfell on YouTube. So I have that. I have a great audio clip from Jenny that I edited in. And just now, I received a 30-minute breakdown of the last episode and kind of like the Night King's music from the one and only Matt Murdock. So I had to get to the computer, record this, and put that in at the end of the episode. So in the show notes, I'll put the time code if you want to jump ahead and just listen to Matt, or if you want to listen to us and Matt, you got the weekend to do so. So thanks, Matt. And remember to listen to Matt's audio blog, Matt's Game of Thrones audio blog. Just search on your iTunes. If you just search Matt's, it'll come up. And he's got great guests, Kelly and Holly and John, and just fantastic. Every week they're breaking down Game of Thrones right after it happens. I love to listen to it. I love to listen to all the podcasts, Bubba, Tower of Babel. I'm listening to Bald Move, so many others. I can't list them all. So just super happy that Matt included this and sent this over to me. So please take a listen to it and enjoy Justin and I first on YouTube, and then we'll get to Matt. Enjoy the show.
Oh, yep, you are live.
Welcome back to Podcast Winterfell, everyone. My name is Axel. Tonight, Justin Thomas of Top Shelf Phantom is joining me here live on the YouTube to take some feedback and talk Game of Thrones Season 8. Episode 3, The Long Night. Find out more about us at podcastwinterfell.com. Justin, my friend, please tell the good people about yourself and where they can find you.
What's going on? I'm Justin Thomas from Top Shelf Phantom, and here jumping in on the Podcast Winterfell for some of these great feedback, some of this great feedback from your podcast listeners, and soon to be hopefully some YouTuber people coming over here, because you know, now we're on the YouTubes too. So yeah, I'm excited for you. So yeah, we are sorry, I had my tripod, as you know, fall. My the lights came crashing down on me literally 2 seconds ago. So
Justin's got trauma, people, just like Game of Thrones. We got it in real life.
I'm Chicken Little over here. The sky's falling, but we're good, baby.
All right, well, listen, we've got some great feedback. I'm very happy Justin's with me. And yes, subscribe to us on YouTube, because we're trying to have a little presence. We're trying to learn and we're trying to have fun. But most of all, we're just trying to talk with people about Game of Thrones. So first off, I want to thank a new listener at The Velvet Days on Twitter, Sir Jacqueline Grace Lacey, Lady of Cats. She just tweeted out some really nice, kind things. You can go over to our Twitter at Winterfell Pod and check that out. And I just always think that's sweet. We've had so many people say we just started listening, or even we found you on YouTube. And I just love that, because this is all about the community and getting new perspectives. And she enjoyed Heath and I doing the deep dive and just talking about kind of the emotional trauma. And she had a question, Justin, which I know you like to talk about, which is kind of like the multi-generational trauma and the kind of the passing down of that in this show. And I think it's something that I mention a lot on the show, and it's something I mentioned so much in my rewatch, which is like, everybody's story is horrific, yo. Like, it's not like, oh, my mom met my dad and they're happily ever after. It's like, my mom killed my brother's uncle and then they drowned the baby and the person was a magic cat. And it's just, it's...
I didn't know you knew my uncle.
Yeah, well, see, you know, it's your monkey uncle.
Sorry, but, Uncle Frank.
I mean, I'm making a little joke there, but seriously, it's some hard stuff. And it's that way for a reason. Because the author, George, and I think the showrunners and the people working on the show have an idea that this is about regeneration. This is about accepting trauma, accepting the past, and moving on in a positive way. I think that that's echoes throughout this multi-generational, and this new generation kind of wants to try to let go of that, you know, even in the way they govern and the way they speak to each other or trust each other. And I think that's a positive thing in the show. What do you think, buddy?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, part of it comes down to, you know, you're always going to have a fair amount of conflict within your story. You know, you don't even the Brady Bunch had their foibles. So, but it's a saga, like you say, the multi-generational stuff. And I find it to be very interesting that everybody tries. We hear this a lot. We hear, I'm going to leave this world a better place than my father left it. Yara and yeah. Danny have that conversation in the show. We have a lot of it in the books as well. But I think it's effective because, you know, we all know that, you know, evolution is not linear per se. And we try to learn from the mistakes of our own mistakes, if we have any, which we have very few, but you know, in the mistakes of those around us in our life, and we learn from struggle. You know, it's that old saying that it's about the journey. But a journey, what is a journey? A journey is struggle.
Yeah.
So you know, yeah, it's, you know, it's great, and I like to think every generation, you know, like Rickard Stark said that he was going to be different. You know, like they all did, you know, everybody.
That's a good point. That's it. Yeah. That's an, and you know what, man, that's true too, because like they've had so much, it's like, it's at some point though, it's just kind of lessening it. And though you're right, you know, that is a great point, dude. Every generation kind of tries in their own way to correct what came before. And this story we're seeing is so much about that, but we see the mistakes that these people have made, and they're the people that come after them will make mistakes, but maybe it's just about being a little bit more open about it or honest about it. So you can, you know, almost like that, you know, kind of like the Hound admitting, maybe the earlier generation of the Hound would never have even as much emotion as he has in this show. You know what I'm saying? Like just a little bit incremental change. We can hope for.
In keeping the good, like we see the folly of the Starks, but you know that the moral and ethical, you know, the very rigid and straightforward, you know, purist approach to that doesn't work out for Ned. You know, he dies for honor, but that is why the Starks are so great, because they get chipped away and they learn different ways to do things, but their foundation. It shouldn't stay, again, like that purist approach, like Ned, where it's like, maybe you should have Renly help you. He's like, that's not the proper feudalistic succession, so I'm not going to do this. And, you know, it's the idea, you can't help your family if you're dead, so you have to stay alive. So, but the foundation of having, you know, living a moral and ethical life to the best of your ability is a pretty good foundation. Yeah. So they get chipped away and come back. So they learn from the mistakes, and they also learn from the good.
That's true. It's not all bad. You're right, man. It's not all the tradition and all the things that are passed down. It's not breaking, you know, breaking the wheel is maybe not the best thing too, because some parts of, you don't want to forget how to make a wheel. That was it. That's what I was going to say.
I never learned. So,
it's true though, right? You know, you think you're so smart and you forget what has come before. So that is in the book. And I know in the show too, where people say, oh no, we know better. We know better. And then
it's like draining the swamp now, right? We'll leave that for another podcast. Work within the system is what I mean. Work within the wheel. If you don't know how to work within the wheel, you can't change anything.
Exactly. Cause it's always going to be a swamp. So you have to figure out how to work within it. Good job. That's true.
That's all I'm saying by that.
I thought we were going to get into a different show. I didn't want to do that. All right. Now, we have another first-time feedback from Ira. Thank you, Ira. Really enjoyed your Season 8, Episode 3 deep dive. One of your listeners, actually, Ira, that was my wife. posited that Bran and the Night King were communicating telepathically moments before Arya killed the Night King. Now, what my wife said is she thought Bran was doing something. It was actually, I think, Heath who said, oh, maybe he was talking with the Night King. Ira continues, I really think this is brilliant. Thanks for sharing. So many people are dissing this brilliant, magnificent episode. Also picking out that Bran did absolutely nothing. If Bran took Night King's attention away, even for a split second, allowing Arya to slip in, then that was imperative to his demise. Now, this is kind of also a thing that I had mentioned, and Justin, I just want to get your kind of mythological theory type thoughts on this. I had posited that maybe even in the split second that Arya was jumping in the air and the Night King was holding her, Bran went back and changed something, or he did something different or something like that, which he wouldn't have to do because Arya could still kill, but he got worried. It was like a Hodor situation and he made a mistake or so. I don't know. What do you think? Do you think we're going to see anything else out of Bran and the magic, or should we tuck that away and enjoy the battle with Cersei?
I think that it's not wrong to ponder these things about Bran. I think the Night King arc is something that people need to get over that actually does hold up. I'm not saying it's beautiful, but I'm saying it holds up. What I'm going to pose here to you, and this is a little bit different than when we talked privately, Bran's mark, his, you know, staff infection that he got from the Night King, that allowed the Night King to track him. And it was also implied that also allowed the Night King to go through the boundaries, you know, the magical barrier in the weirwood tree. Yep. And it was implied that that would be the only reason that the Night King could get past the wall. So here's the issue that I do have with Bran. I think that what you said, and we talked about this before, there is no implication and there's nothing that should lead us to believe that if Bran did interject in that scenario, that we should be able to see it in the moment. That is not the best, you know, method to go about this when it's a visual medium. And again, like, if that is the case,
there's
then
no
we have some exposition being dropped. So yeah. Here's my question. Bran had to go beyond the wall. He needed to gather information. The information he gathered was Jon's true parentage and that the Children of the Forest weaponized, you know, the Night King. And then if he came back in the reason, and it does hold up with the rules they've set, that the only way the Night King, you know, came through the wall, dragon or not, was because there's supposedly the same magic right. that was in that
well,
tree.
Well, see, they never, that might be a part of the books, that the wall is magical, and then people had said, oh, now that Bran's touched, once he passes the wall, the Night King, like it was a double thing. The Night King had to get the dragon and get Bran through the wall with the mark on him, but I don't think that there's really anything in the show that says that the mark that's had anything to do with the wall.
Yeah, they just cite the magical barrier. So, you know, that's a question of mine is, you know, okay, why did Bran need to lead the Night King to the Godswood? And because that's a big, you know, gaping hole if it is the fact that the only reason he can get past the wall is if Bran goes past the wall. So essentially you're looking at a scenario, and I'm just laying it out, that Bran brought the army of the dead in order to, you know, deliver Jon that parentage, the information about his you know, true you know, parentage. So I'm struggling even without that little paradox, because really what seems to me to be the most important and why I think Bran is still going to play a role is because the biggest piece of information that he holds to be important is the, you know, the lineage, Jon's true parentage. So that doesn't play with the Night King, obviously. So that must, whether he foresees something, there is the, you know, it's injected in the story that the Green Seers can see a little bit in the future. It's like glimpses, not always accurate and so forth. So, you know, I guess the way to look at it is, I don't know if he did anything in that moment, and I think that that's going to be best left up to our imagination, if he Doctor Strange did or not, because that's just some heavy exposition at the beginning of the next episode or wherever, you know, where he's like, actually, guys, I heard the fans said I wasn't doing anything.
And then it like reverses, goes doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo-doo.
Yeah. So, you know, that it's a dangerous weapon, Bran, is, because you either say he did nothing or you weaponize that man, and he can make this story very, very quickly. The story can spin out of control, meaning stakes can be lost because we have time travel. So, we have a ultimate beast, you know, there.
I like what you're saying, which is what you're saying. Look, regardless of all the magic and everything, it really boils down to two pieces of information. He's used the Night King part. He's also told the John part. But is there going to be anything else past that? I don't know. I agree with that. But there's, I think, a third part that he brought with him, which is that he now holds the history of that world. Yes. So I do think that's why I think I'm not ready to say, I don't know if I totally go with the theory, Ira. And I don't know if Bran took away the Night King's attention for Arya. I think Arya did her thing. Needed no one else to do it. She's a deadly ninja assassin and she took care of it. She got the job done. But I do think maybe Bran and the magic isn't done yet. And as Justin said, there's like information gathered there. And I think if you add, you have the Night King, you have Jon's parentage, those things are kind of delivered. But in that big town hall meeting, they talked about how he holds the memories and blah, blah, blah. And I think that's an important concept because they may at some point want to say, okay, Bran, you didn't die there. The memories continue. Now what? Because at some point you're going to die, Bran. Are you an everlasting being now? Are we gonna, should we go put you in a tree now, Bran? What's the next step? Like, is Bran going to say, look, we need to start replanting the weirwoods. We need to start, like, there still has to be a next step.
Yes. Well, this is all I'll say about this, Ira. The only problem is if this information turns out to be not significant in the episodes to come, we are faced with a little bit of a dilemma, because that is a issue of, we just had Bran do what he did because we needed to bring the story to our characters, meaning it needed to happen in the Godswood, you know, just for our story.
So he just needed to sit there doing nothing so he could be lured there. Well, but I think that might, you know what, Justin, that might be it. I mean, he was kind of bait, you know?
Did he have to be bait in the Godswood? So I guess, I mean, I think a lot of this is going to be ambiguous. And I think that,
that's an interesting idea. You're right. It was his suggestion, right?
Yes, but he can shed light on the past, like you said. Okay. And that is very valuable, especially when you got the intellectual like Sam that can sit there, you know, and tell him where to look. Maybe we get Lyanna and Rhaegar at the Tourney of Arrenhall. Maybe we get a insight into, you know, like something that happened in the past that affects the story and affects the claimant for the throne. You know how that goes about. Okay. He can play a role because he can provide information. The only information he's provided so far is all we can go off of right now. So yes, I think we're right to be as Ira is, and I think we're all on the same level here. We're kind of like hedging our bets right now.
We're hopeful because it would be fun, but it's kind of pure theoretical now because there's a battle that has to come. That's cool. Ira, thank you so much for writing in. And Justin, of course, thank you for being here with me and talking feedback. This is fun. Live on the YouTubers. John Wambacher, patron, friend, public servant, also was on the roundtable a few weeks ago. We're going to be doing that again, but I think only with like 3-4 people. DJ is going to take care of it. We had like 50 people and too many people. We're going to slow it down because we want everyone to get a chance to talk more. Justin was on that show. You were great, Justin.
Thank you. Yeah, I was there.
That's him.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. I got to meet a lot of cool people.
I can see you.
It's nice, the merging of the podcast and the YouTube world.
Yeah, the merge. When worlds
collide.
The fire and the ice. Which one is which?
We're a podcaster. YouTube's. Yeah, yeah. So it'll be good.
Okay, John. I really enjoyed the episode, but don't you think we should have seen the effects of using the dragon glass more? There really was no payoff. We didn't see any of the White Walkers killed by it. Now, I have to say, John, I disagree a little because I think it was kind of, we should have just taken for granted that a lot of people had those weapons and that's the only reason they could even last that long. And we did see a couple of White Walkers explode when they went into the barricades with the dragon glass sticking out of it.
Yes.
But John also mentions, I thought they'd be, the archers would be set, it would just be going off like tons of archers with dragon glass arrows. I'm not into that stuff and like the battlements, though I think it can be cool and I like the action photography and all that. But I have to say, John has a point. There was a lot of dragon glass up to this point. Sam had to find it in the book and send the note to John, and John went to Dragonstone.
After Stannis already told him he had to find it again.
What's that?
Stannis tells him in
It was such a big trail to the dragon glass, and it was such a big part of John meeting Dany. And while
I was going to go there. You took my thing. Yeah. I was going
to
say
they went into the cave.
Instead of looking at for the payoff here, look at how it's functioned throughout our story so far.
Oh, okay. See, you're bringing up something I wasn't thinking. Can you say that point again, Justin?
You were saying it, that's what I mean, the function that it serves so far, that it's brought the reason that John, you know, maybe he would have went to Dragonstone, you know, without the dragon glass being there. But that, you know, that's what really sold him. It's like, all right, okay, I'm going to go and make an effort because there's something, there's multiple reasons. You know, he sees opportunity when Dany goes there. Dany has something that he needs. And it's not just her dragons, it's glass.
You're saying it's about the journey, not the destination. Dragon glass brought us on a journey. The destination was this battle where they kind of used it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was a part of it, but maybe we didn't have to see everybody like, get the dragon glass, you know, like in Hard Home.
I mean, I'm with him in the sense of too, that I thought there should have been more lulls with the white attacks because of the how chaotic that was, and you should have had a few what I call side boss battles. You know how you had like Umber and Tormund and the Battle of the Bastards? You should have had Jaime and Brienne or somebody, you know, with Valyrian face off against White Walkers, because that films better. It's less crazy. It was just, but I think they were really going for that, just like the horror of this, because everybody other than John and Dany are literally just trying to survive. Like they don't think they're gonna like defeat the Whites, because it's just, well, they should be burning them, but you know what I mean? But I agree. I mean, but this is a situation where it's like, it was this high fantasy battle, and I was pretty, actually, satisfied with it. And I'm not even really like for that. I'm more for the conventional warfare. So, but yeah, we're always, I mean, it's not like John's wrong here. They definitely could have done things that were better, but you know, I think the Valyrian steel in one-on-one battles with the individual White Walkers.
See, 14 I think that's what it, I was saying it. I didn't even realize I was saying it. You picked up on it, and now I totally agree with it, which is that both the Valyrian steel, the dragon glass, those things were laid because they all told us, get the White Walkers. They played into the overall plot. They were valuable along the journey to remind us. They're staples. It's like I talk about and you talk about how, you know, you use words in world to recognize that, right? Like this is the way you world build. You create words and you use them. You say Valyrian steel a lot. You say dragon glass. And then you use it to get John to go to Dany. And you get the Valyrian steel becomes swords. And it's about tradition. And it's about the mythology in the past. So I agree too. It would have been cool though to have a couple of close-ups, like maybe some guy was kind of nervous, you know, and he had the dragon glass and he goes, ugh, and then the white explodes.
Yeah, well, I mean, like, you know, for a family to have a Valyrian steel sword is a big deal. That's why the Lannisters get theirs. Yeah. They sent Tyrion's favorite uncle in the books was sent off. I'm blanking on his name, but he went to
Uncle Tyrion.
It's not, but you know what I mean? Like, they really, it's a status thing as well.
Yes. No, I know that, but I was saying it, for John's point, if I'm going to interject myself as the director of this episode for a moment, I'm going to say, hey, camera, make sure that we get, let's do that shot we talked about where that scared old guy we showed picks up a dragon glass and he, and we see the white explode. So we see the power of the dragon glass in the battle and we start to understand that it's actually an important part of the battle. Maybe they didn't do that enough. So let's move on. Cause I think we, unless I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt. Did you have some more dragon glass to talk about?
No, I just would like to add one more thing that it's, okay. It's interesting too, that the great houses have the Valyrian steel and then the regular soldiers have the dragon glass. Yeah. So it's like a status thing, but, I like the idea, you know, we see like the, ceremony of, Sam giving, Heartsbane to Jorah. So these houses, these lords, these great houses are supposed to protect the realm. So they have it for status when the White Walkers aren't charging, you know, through the wall, because, you know, it's all, you know, nonsense to them until it's in their face, which is understandable. But, you know, it turns into from a status symbol to, you know, like now, hey, you know how you have all this power. Now you need to use that, you know, like trophy that you got to actually guard the realm of men.
Yep. That's true. Right. Exactly. Like we saw with Sam and yeah, that's a good point, man. I like that. That's a good thematic point. All right. John Lee. One character got the complete shaft during the long night, an important character from the beginning that has become more and more unimportant. It's Ghost. He looked amazing as a set piece on the Vanguard with the Dothraki and Jorah, but go out like a fart in the wind? Now, wait, I have to stop. Some people say Ghost is alive. Is Ghost confirmed alive? Or Justin, do you know this?
Yeah, you're I think a purist, he's alive. Yes, he's alive.
Yeah,
They couldn't pay for the CGI to get him back.
Okay, I think, look, he's alive. We can, I think it's not a huge spoiler to say that Ghost is alive because the battle was, you know, it was hard to see if anybody was alive. I don't think they were trying. The thing disappears and reappears, the dog, so I don't think it's a spoiler. I'm sorry about that, Brett, if you think that's a spoiler. But I want to continue with John's letter because it's funny. The whole time, John is fighting through the recently raised dead, I'm thinking to myself, oh, shit, Ghost is going to come jump at John as an undead wolf. But nope, even in death, Ghost gets the shaft. There was a rule, if a character wasn't killed on screen, they weren't dead. I suppose the Blackfish is dead, Stannis is dead, Cyril Pharrell could actually be dead. And Ghost could in fact be dead as well. Or Ghost could be alive, because we think Ghost is alive. John continues, I love the episode, but my only complaint was the amount of hero plot armor passed out. I'm glad he said this because I have a weird theory on it. When Jaime, Brienne, and Pod are pinned against the wall, Sam is backstroking in a sea of undead. I was fully prepared for all of their deaths, but nope. First I want to hear what you have to say about this, Justin.
Well,
The Jamie Brienne pot against a wall and Sam in a sea of dead.
Yeah, I went over this a little bit in my test stream, how they utilize the rule of three, you know, establishing pattern and breaking it with a fourth. You get your dollar a sad death, you get Jorah's death, and you get Theon. You know, you don't get a lot of big names. We are at a point in the story where a lot of these characters, unfortunately, because of the medium, I'm not dogging on it. We don't have all these, you know, it's still the largest cast ever in television history. But, you know, okay, Sam represents the Reach at this point. Tormund represents the Free Folk. If we have to look at who's going to rule the Seven Kingdoms or how they're going to rule it, and they're trying to save something, it's kind of, they're in a bad situation because you almost can't kill off a lot of these characters. And we're so used to that at this point,
because
that's what it was built off of. But like, unfortunately, if you kill Tormund, then there's no representation of the Free Folk that is familiar. So, you know, like, I obviously know there's other wildlings, but you know, like that's how television works. We need to have a character that's established. And, you know, that's why the houses like are very much symbolic of the lands in which they live in, you know, and so forth. So, yeah, I thought that there could have been, I thought Brienne should have died. I thought that was my prediction. Not because I don't like her. I really like her, but because her arc was complete. And even though I have a Sansa video coming out where I think they can still do stuff with her, but I really did want to see somebody die. Like, you know, like Rob, it's just the idea of people can die now because their arc is complete. Well, it's really impactful when, you know, Rob Stark dies because his arc is anything but complete. You know what I mean?
Exactly.
He's about to go for...
And dude, that's what makes this show great, is that it's real. That completes their arc. The idea that everything should be the walking dumb dead, where the episode the person dies, you really get to know them and their arc is complete. No, that's not the way life is. Not everybody, that your arc doesn't, you could live to 90 and your arc isn't complete.
You can finally get in the medical school after working your whole life up and die that next day.
It's great. Like the Rob thing was great. He's on the rise. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like Ned thing. Oh, we think the politics is going to continue. Oh no. Joffrey, off with the head.
Yeah, but we can't have the jostling for power within the kingdoms if we kill off these. They are literally, like, you know, you're getting more, even we're getting away from the high fantasy for these last three episodes, like in Tolkien's work, you know, like characters, like individual characters represent like whole, like, you know, like wildlife or, you know.
I understand what you're saying, but may I make one?
Yeah, it's your show.
One theory. Oh, it's our show, pal. Whenever you're on with me, this is our place that we made together, just like in Lost, which one day I'm going to get you to watch and you're going to love it.
I will try it.
Okay. This is my crazy theory. They were protected by the Lord of Light.
Oh, God.
Okay. I'm just saying it was pretty bad. They were up against that wall for like an hour and a half and they were just like, oh, it was. I accept it. We talked about it on the pod a little bit. It's a TV show.
To be fair, John was protected by the Lord of Light. They don't in the Battle of the Bastards. They, you know, they do talk about that. They wanted to make sure to showcase that he was.
Like,
you know, all the craziness. Yeah. I'm not joking.
No, I'm not. I think that it's a part of the show, right?
Yeah,
we're
never
going to find
exactly why.
Right. But. That's why I kind of said it, bro, because one of the huge plot points of this episode is that Melisandre had been like Littlefinger when we found out about Jon Arryn, blah, blah, blah. She had been moving little pieces and also Arya in those pieces. And the result was this. So in the same way, we could say maybe the Lord of Light works in mysterious ways. And in this world, it's possible that they were protected, you know? And then that's why these things occur. I don't know if we're ever going to know it. We're probably never going to talk about it. They might not even mention the Lord of Light again. But I think it was just worth saying. All right.
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah. Oh, did you want to say something?
No, absolutely. You just see a lot of your character moments really come from Arya. She evokes the character moments in the lulls. Everybody else kind of is in a repetitive state. And again, I like this episode,
great,
but with
point.
The whites. So, you know, but Arya was utilized.
She's going forward. And dude, that is a great point. And it's even, wow, Justin, I knew there was a reason why I liked you.
Yeah, would you just figure, what, you didn't think, I'm starting to think you didn't think I was smart before.
But you're totally right. If you even think about it from a view of cinematography, of camera, of motion, she was constantly moving, going forward, and propelling other characters forward, right? Beric, the Hound, things moving forward. Everyone else, you're right, was like in stasis or became trapped or was pushed back and forth. They were at the mercy of something else. She seemed to have her own way through
agency.
Things. Yes, she had.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right, we have a longer email. I'll read the beginning and then why don't you jump in and ask some of these questions. Okay, Justin?
Okay.
This is from, I think I'm pronouncing this correctly, Diogo, D-I-O-G-O. I'm trying. From Brazil. Awesome. Love it. So many people this season have reached out to me from different countries, and that's what I love about the internet and this show. It's worldwide. I'm from Brazil and I really enjoy your podcast. Too bad it took me 8 GOT seasons to find it. You can go back. Like our friend Roberto, I have also mixed feelings about the episode. But Arya killing the Night King the way she did made up for the low points. There are more pros than cons about the episode, of course. Let's start with the cons. I hope you refute them. because I don't like being bitter about the show. Neither do we. Ghost's role was too small. We kind of talked about that, but it would have been cool. But they always say the CGI thing. I don't really think that's actually true. I think that it's because they spend seed money on other things. I think it's that it's just a big dog attacking things. And I think, I don't know, it gets maybe a little repetitive. It's just kind of jumping around. It always ends up looking like Twilight. And I'm kind of glad that they don't have Ghost in the show more. I got to be honest with you. Mm-hmm. That's how I feel.
Yeah, I did do a lot of research, and I have about an hour and a half long video that serves as a really shitty movie talking about this. And it you're right, they have the money, yeah. But it's the time for the texture. I always cite this. Look at when the John, texture, before he's say? Resurrected, spoiler, when I think it's episode 3 of season 6, yeah. When Ghost is howling out there, take a look at that Ghost. That's 70% Ghost, and it's very blurry. It's the texturing. It's very time consuming.
I agree with you on that, Justin, but that's still saying that it's somehow a technical aspect.
I did this video because of the same frustration you feel because of the budget. So yeah, I'm with you.
I think it's both.
Telling me they got to pick between dragons and dire wolves?
Exactly. It's both. Yeah. I think you're right. It's texture. Let's put it this way. It's the amount of time that goes into it and the result you get out of it.
Let's
move on. They should have used more fire against the whites, especially dragon fire before the Dothraki attack. I know John and Danny were saving the dragons to fight the Night King, but one Dracarys wouldn't hurt. And also when the whites were climbing up the walls, it seemed an obvious strategy they didn't explore. I don't know much about battle, but I do know that fire has its own way of spreading. So if you light the side of the castle on fire, or you're using so much fire, you know, I think they tried to use it. And also you saw the aspect. One thing I notice is, dragons are like, you know, make wide right turn. You know, you can't just turn. They, or else John and Danny aren't good at doing the spin move or whatever, like a TIE fighter can do. It has to whip around. So I think in essence, any complaint against the battle strategy of our heroes can be chalked up to two things. They're really not that good, and they've shown that before. They kind of lose every battle almost, except when Danny has a clear shot of burning everyone. And they were up against a crazy force that was not only intimidating physically, but mentally, psychologically, had no stopping. So they were it was berserker-style amphetamines craziness. Yeah. So that's how I see it.
Yeah, it was sequenced out to the, methed out zombie horde.
Yes,
was just trying to be held off by the others. And then there was the cat and mouse game that involved Danny, John, Arya, and, Theon ends up playing his role. But here's what I'll say about it. We can adhere to conventional warfare and play armchair general, which I enjoy doing. I think there's some fun to that. Obviously, like it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to send. You should never send cavalry without infantry, is like the old saying General Ney did in Waterloo, that he was on the French side. The Light Brigade by Colonel Carnegie. That's where Carnegie comes out. Just look up Carnegie and General Ney and see. But here's the point. You notice I call it tricks and games. Every single battle starts with a trick, right? The wildfire by Tyrion, Ramsay's game, Akra being lit. And it's actually always a cult. It's always it's the catalyst that has the battle ensue. So they are following a sequence of events that Miguel uses that works really well. They definitely should have battered them to hell with, arrows and the ballista for far longer before they put a charge. It definitely should have set up the trench right away and put a choke point. I mean, yeah, we could go through this. I mean, I think, most of us figure that wasn't the best way, but it's like in the end, I guess, like, that's fun, like if we want to do a stream just about that, and I'm totally
you,
with
you. You can like because that. I have no interest. I don't know anything about that kind of stuff. So
yeah, but I mean, I'm just armchairing it too. Yeah. You know, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, and I always found that interesting coming up to this with all these videos of how to beat the White Walkers, and
but people have fun. I thought,
how do you beat something that you don't know like what they're trying to get?
I agree, and I think one thing that people always forget that they showed in this episode. The 10 minutes of hearing as Jorah looks out is the psychological intimidation. And also, as Heath and I talked about on our pod, a lot of people like to look at a battle and envision themselves as a hero or a superhero, when in fact, it is very scary. If you are the bravest person in the world, you should be scared.
Yeah.
And that is a huge factor. Let's move on from that. Let's see. I actually just got an email from Brett that we're going to throw in here. Thanks, Brett. Let's see. We talked about Bran. Oh, this is interesting. We kind of talked about this a little bit. Diogo, I'm trying to pronounce that correctly, concurs. Not really a con, but the previous episode seemed like such a farewell episode that I spent the week getting emotionally ready to see some of the favorite characters die.
That's on purpose. That's done in every single one.
Brienne, Pod, Tormund, Davos. It was all for nothing. On the other hand, I'm glad we'll see some of them fight Cersei, who is
subverting expectations. So yes. It worked.
Yeah.
They did, you know, that's, I'll just touch on it really quick. Battle of the Bastards. You have a scene with Tormund and Davos. And it's just dialogue that is, it's left open ended. It is, it would serve well as a farewell.
Yes.
So meaning great they're not point. Talking about things they're going to do. They're just talking about the situation they're in and kind of just like the,
And Justin, isn't that actually add to the reality because they think they're going to die?
Yeah.
Right? Like I don't necessarily it is subverting expectations. And it's a technique, but I also think it's a good way of showing how people really do react to something like that. They really do say, hey, look.
Looking for finality. And,
yeah.
But yeah, you want to have those moments because it's true to life. Like you said, yes, you would want to, you know, if we were about to go into battle, I know I'd be sweet. I'm sweet with a sword and I'm badass, but I'd want to make sure to like, you know, you're a good friend of mine. I'd like to, you'd be like, you know, it's been nice knowing you. You want to have those little moments. You don't want to be like, let's make sure to, you know, pay our phone bill on Wednesday, you know, when the battle's on Monday. You don't want to like say stuff like that because that puts the audience in the state of mind of, you know, what's happening for these characters after.
Definitely.
Definitely. You want everybody to be up for grabs, even in Thrones.
All right. Now for the pros. It blew the audience away. Everyone on the live streams I watched or talked to today said they needed some time to catch their breath after it was all done, myself included. It even made me feel the urge to write to you about it. You know what? That is a great, simple point that a lot of people, we kind of gloss over, say, what an episode. But you know what? They did a masterful job of setting us up. Sam to Sam's hands to Melisandre falling in the snow. Whether you hated it at the end, loved it at the end, had problems with it, whatever, plot armor, whatever you're going to say, it was completely enthralling. And it was one of the most tense and emotional. My heart was beating for an hour and a half. Did you feel that way, Justin? Were you at all taken out of it, or did this just get you? Because it got me. And I just want the spectacle worked. And sometimes, you know what? I like this. I'm not here for the spectacle, but I like that. It's fun.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with that. I do want to address, because we got some people in the chat, thank you everybody for joining us, and please make sure to subscribe to this channel. Axel's trying to get it going. Everybody
sorry
is.
About that. Yes.
And Sly the Tank Benjamin, wow, that's a badass name. Just like Littlefinger said, best way to confuse your enemy is to never let them know your true intention. So yeah, you know, if you let people know your desires, then, you know, they know how to defeat you. They, you know, they know what you're going for. They know
what's that in reference to?
Just talking about
battle plans and stuff.
What's that?
Was that in reference to, is he talking about kind of battle plans and stuff like that?
Yeah, and oh, okay. I just wanted to, because he tagged us in there, so I want to, and that is a relevant point, so absolutely. I really enjoyed this battle. My heart stopped for an hour and a half, and I found that to be weird, but it happened to Dick Cheney, too, he's fine.
That's true. That was a great part of that movie, actually. Where he kept on having a heart attack. it was just sitting there. Hey, okay, I think we better go to the hospital.
Yeah. I really enjoyed it. I think that I'm getting a little sick of and it's kind of odd too, because I've been very positive these last two seasons. When I first started making YouTube videos, I thought I had to be a contrarian and try to, say how much better things could be. There's no value in that, and that doesn't enhance my enjoyment. You definitely have to speak truth and not lie and say when you don't think things were done well.
Definitely.
And there's glaring holes. But here's the thing. There's so many people that are so mad about, how we love Game of Thrones because it doesn't have heroes or pure good versus evil. But now there's a lot of people that in some of the top content creators out there that after this show, they were mad because the show that we loved so much for not having heroes didn't have a hero kill the Night King. The Night King didn't die in the way they wanted. The Arya, who everybody loves except for me, usually, assassinates somebody as an assassin. So they found, like, when she did that to the Freys, everybody clapped. When she did it to the Night King, everybody said, what the hell? That's not right. The story that is about the folly of prophecy and the roads that takes you down, Stannis burning Shireen and being like one of the best generals, if not the best, in the Seven Kingdoms at this time, essentially losing that battle tactically to a butcher's boy. But then they're mad because we didn't get a prophet. Where's our Azora High? I every reason that you state, about subverting tropes, this isn't like this, is every reason that people are complaining about this episode. Where's our hero? Where's our prophet? Where's this? It's like, in this story.
What, Justin? You know that I agree with you. I think this entire story is about how history is false, how prophecies and legends are not as valuable as the people right in front of your face and your actual human relationships and the actions of one single person. And I think that I can understand, though. I can understand why. And actually, Jenny sent in an audio clip that talked all about this. So on the podcast, I'm going to play that now. All right, we got some great feedback here from Jenny. We couldn't figure out how to play it through YouTube, so I'm going to take it myself right now. I'm going to play it. It's an audio clip. Love it.
Hey, Axel, it's Jenny. I hope that you can hear this okay. I am recording while I'm walking outside at work, and it's a little breezy out here. I just finished listening to you and Heath on the podcast, and I was really excited to hear the additional portion that you had taken out of the beginning, apparently, where you felt it was more negative. But when I had been listening to earlier parts, I wanted to respond to things, but then you had basically addressed all the things I wanted to respond to in that additional portion. And I wanted to give you credit because over the time that I've listened to Podcast Winterfell, which has been a few years at least, when it was Matt's podcast and you would be on during the showtime, I learned from you because of your experience in working in film and stuff, and you made me realize that part about the people making these shows are humans with lives as well. I mean, you would think that would be common sense, but we don't always think things through to that logical conclusion. So I wanted to thank you because you've made me see that for quite some time now. And some of the people that I talk to about the show, actually most of the people in my real life that I talk to about the show, they just want to be that, they're surface watchers. They haven't read the books, but also they just want more Game of Thrones, and they don't think about the amount of time that this production has taken out of so many people's lives. And I also, due to things that you have said in the past and continue to say, I've learned that even though I'm a book reader, that I need to appreciate the show for what it is. I understand why people were not necessarily keen on the whole Arya killing the Night King, mostly because of the Azor Ahai prophecy and all of that. But people who just watch the show, most of them that haven't read any books or haven't podcasted or listened to podcasts, those people, they don't care about Azor Ahai. So I had been fine with Arya killing the Night King, even though I am a book reader, because to me, this is the show. It's not the books. I don't know how George is going to handle it, if and when he ever gets to it in the books. But when I saw Arya coming at the Night King from the back and her little ninja move, I literally grinned the biggest grin on my face and clapped. I was giddy like a little child. It was amazing. And I don't want to be called a fangirl, but I kind of am a fangirl sometimes, so that was awesome. But anyway, that's really all I have. I'm not going to be able to watch episode 4 until like a week later, so I'm going to have to unfollow all my groups so that I don't get spoiled. But I will follow you guys back and be back after episode 5. So, Valar Morghulis.
Thank you so much, Jenny. That is awesome. I appreciate it. I appreciate all the kind words. Thank you very much. And Jenny, you have taught me too. Everybody who writes in or communicates back has taught me over time. And yeah, that's just a point that I've always felt, you know. I mean, look, the next thing you know, it could be Heath Solo in the next Game of Thrones, you know? And then we're talking about him like that dumb actor. So I always try to think about that these are real people making the show. And my expectations are always tempered by that, you know? It takes time and effort to do it. And I appreciate that. And even if I don't, like if you take that away, as some people say, well, hey, you have to judge things as they are. I still think Game of Thrones is absolutely incredible, faults and warts and all, you know, and I've had many problems with the show. And as far as the Arya thing goes, which I'm sure Justin and I will discuss, I can see both sides of that. I can understand being attached to a mythology or a theory or something that's in a book. Even though I haven't read the books yet, and I will, because I have a one-track mind and I need to keep myself on the show, I just totally mix things up all the time. So when it's done, I'll watch the show. And then when the prequels come, that will just be added knowledge that I'll have going into the prequel or whatever they end up making. I can understand that. And I sympathize and empathize with the people. So I don't get upset, you know. But I'm still going to say my point, which is that I'm happy that it was Arya. I think it makes total sense. She was an assassin. She assassinated. I thought it was super cool and it was fun. And I think Jon has his role. I don't dislike Jon. It's not an either or equation. I like Jon a lot. I've come to love the character more so upon my rewatch. So I just love Game of Thrones and I'm just all about talking about it in all the different ways, but also remaining respectful for the actual human beings who not only make the show, but who are also fans like us, podcasters on Twitter, whatever. Just try to remain respectful. And like when I say people were talking about that prophecy and I said, I wish I knew why this was so important. Because to me, it seems like the point of the show is to kind of buck prophecy and start something new, right? So it makes sense that maybe it's purposefully a huge part of the book that's wrong. Is that, I want to discuss it with somebody. Hopefully Justin and I will discuss it because I'm really interested in it. You know, it's not like I'm like, I don't automatically think if somebody likes the prophecy that, oh, they're bad, they don't like Arya. No, they can like both things at the same time. Just like I like Jon and I like that this happened. Maybe he is a Zor, what do I know? You know, so it's just kind of fun to bandy it all about, but also keep it within the realm of having fun and watching a TV show and just discussing it with friends. So I appreciate that audio message, Jenny. It's good to hear your voice. Taking a little break here. Justin, thanks for joining me. And thank you to Cufflinks.com for supporting the show and being the presenting sponsor. They've got tons of great GOT products. Use code GOT20 and get 20% off your order today. GOT20, awesome stuff. Targaryen, Stark, whatever side you choose, they've got it. Cufflinks.com/DVR. Use code GOT20 today. But we're here on YouTube, so I'm going to continue. But the point is,
I really enjoyed that audio.
Yeah, it was great. That's my podcast trick. The point is that people get into it and they attach themselves mm-hmm. to a theory. And I'm not going to judge, because I think that the internet and often life becomes an either or situation. If either you like this or you like that, I like to do both. I think people are generally not hypocritical, but people can act in a dual nature. So I accept that. And I accept the fact that I can think John is awesome. I can love mm-hmm. his journey. But I can also think that it was, in a sense, metaphor, that he was swinging at the dragon like Don Quixote at windmills mm-hmm. while Arya took direct action and got the job done, doing what she was trained to do, cutting through prophecy, cutting through history, cutting through tradition to do it. And I like that and appreciate that. But I'll tell you this, if Jon had a kick-ass flaming sword battle with the Night King, that probably would have been pretty cool. And mm-hmm. I think that
it was cool at Hardhome.
Yeah, exactly. That was cool. And you know what? We still have 3 episodes to go. So before we say that Jon is not a hero, let's watch the rest of the episodes. And let's also think about the fact that not every hero has the killing blow. Sometimes the hero is the person who brings them together. And also, our story is not about a hero. Our story is about a pack. The pack survives. Yeah. They're all heroes.
Yeah. If I can just clear up what I'm saying, it's because there are heroes in our story, but the heroes in their
I know what you mean.
Their good intentions don't, you know, result like just automatically good. But my thing is of course, I like and I dislike it. That is the whole point of the Stab Discourse. It is when we have people that are the ultimate authorities on this show, you know, due to the algorithm. And, you know, they're not just saying they don't like it. They're saying that it's the worst and it's bad storytelling.
That's where I have the problem with it. Look,
they have a fundamental misunderstanding of it. I wanted
to discuss, not interrupt you. I apologize. That's the way people are. People get upset about stuff. People get upset. And there's some people who enjoy the fight and the discussion at that level. And there's other people who enjoy just to say, hey, it's a show, watch it. But the one thing I always say is I try not to get too upset at anybody, because we all love the same thing. And really, we are a small minority in the 98% of the rest of the world watching this, who just watches a TV show once a week. So we just got to keep it in perspective.
And I just think people wouldn't be as negative as they've been about this if we didn't have so many big voices. People have a lot of sway, for better or worse.
I don't know about that. And
it's important to recognize that's the way life is, though, Justin.
That's the way everything is. There's always people that listen to other people and voices rise up. And there's those who choose to listen to the big voice. And there's those who choose to listen to all voices. And they're going to be that way regardless if there's a big voice or not.
No, I'm not trying to sling mud. I like a lot of those big voices. My opinion on it and just say that, somebody that has been very critical in the past, listen, this, just think about the aspect of, if you're not happy that Arya killed Night King, fair enough, because it was kind of a quick, I didn't mind it, but it was very quick. But let me just pose this to you. The decision to have Arya kill the Night King was made season 3. The decision was not made off of who can kill the Night King. The decision was made based off of who deserves in the show to kill the Night King. So even if somebody else kills the Night King, just that function itself tells you that it changes the story slightly, just in the sense of that's the person that killed the Night King. But the story's not going to be different.
Why do you say that? You know what I mean? But what? Oh, if somebody else killed the Night King, you mean?
Yeah, because the decision wasn't made. That, Arya wasn't the only one that could do it. They decided on her.
Yes.
I try to look at the story in a more broader sense.
Yeah, that I agree with. We don't know. We don't know because we're not in the writer's room. And also, let me just reiterate this again. Whenever you see anyone from the show doing an interview, they are working their job. So welcome to that. Or when they're talking to a journalist, they are on the job. And when you're on the job, you talk like things that you say you should speak on the job. You're not talking to your friend. So it's still a quote. So I always just leave it to the imagination and say they had like you said, Justin, because I started thinking, what happens if it was Theon? Oh, I could come up with the reason why he did it. What happens if it was Brienne? Oh, I could come. What happens if it was Jaime? Oh, the Mad King. So there's.
What does it mean for the world that he's dead? And what does it mean for the person that killed them?
Yeah, exactly. You could come up with so many variations.
Of course,
on
it changes. Yeah. But it's not, you know. And again, we're at the end of a story that we love.
Right.
Stories need resolution. But again, this is not something that the psychiatry behind this and that they've done studies with the dopamine dropping and the serotonin. It is like losing people. We don't even, realize it, but they do studies on people like the binge watch on Netflix and stuff. You know, I mean, it's the end. We're not going to see our buddies anymore. You know, these people that we feel very attached.
That's why I'm empathetic about it, Justin, and I also try to let people make mistakes online. And if somebody gets mad about something or clap back, I just say, okay, I'm not gonna.
No, I'm not trying to.
Somebody could be having a bad day.
I'm trying to put a different perspective out.
You are.
It's really not out there. When there's usually a lot of apologists, and it's surprising that it's the very positive people that literally sometimes will take dog crap and tell them that it's, you know, filet mignon.
I've been accused of that. I have people.
I'm just trying to be a little bit of sunshine in the rare chance that I can be. you know, well, stop trying to rain on my parade. I'm trying to be positive.
You are the sunshine. Screw it, guys. You're the sunshine of my life. You're the sunshine
of my life.
Why you kill
the Night King like that, man?
All right. Let's go. See, that's the thing is I don't want to do is I don't want to generalize.
You made me do that. Made me do that now. Oh, I wasn't doing that. Now you forced me to. Well, don't say you don't want. That's what you did.
All right, okay. Let's move on.
Let's go.
The fact that the dagger used to save Bran was the same one used to try and kill him, that it passed through the hands of so many characters and was the source of so much controversy, was awesome. I agree, and I loved it. And I think that's such a great part of this show. And it made me think of how now the opening credits, instead of showing the history of 17 years ago, we see the history that we've seen on the show. And we see the way history, we stopped talking about Robert's Rebellion and they started talking about what we've seen with Ned dying and Joffrey dying and Dany getting dragged. Like, we know that history, and that knife, that dagger, is a reminder of that and a reminder of how deep the plot goes, but also a reminder that everything goes back to Littlefinger.
Yeah, it goes back to that. You got to climb down that ladder. He was trying to climb to the chaos.
Yeah.
We do have one comment here that this story was not about good and evil, and you're right. It's not in the... The aspect is that this monster that is dead now, the one that they were saying was evil, there is empathy for that person. That person was weaponized against their will in another attempt to create peace through chaos. So, you know, now they have to deal with the monster within. This has got a lot of grays. But yes, you still have positive and negative emotional transitions throughout the story. That's what it's about. Yeah. And it's going through that roller coaster. But yeah, definitely. In things like the cat's paw there, that's beautiful. Like, is that something that's like had to happen? No, but that's a great example of something that was smart. Like, they made sure to have that like serve so many purposes. And then it comes into play at the end. Yep. It didn't need. She could have like picked up a chip of, you know what I mean? It could have been something.
Exactly.
But that's awesome.
Oh, you know what? Also, Justin,
layer your story.
She could have handed Sansa the cat's paw to go down to the go down to the crypts instead of, and then just use a piece of dragon glass. But no, it was that dagger. So yeah, you're right, dude. I love it. I'm sorry, dude. I'm from New Jersey. I apologize. I love how everything was so dark and foggy and chaotic. It was very realistic. See, I like that someone said that. We don't need to talk about it being dark. Everybody's talked about it. But from a cinematic perspective, if you could see it, let's not talk about that. I liked the choice. I thought it was a strong choice. It was called The Long Night. It was dark. It was chaotic. It was like Saving Private Ryan. You didn't know what the hell was going on. It added so much to everything. I know you love that too, Justin.
Yeah, I'll just say one thing. There, be careful of walking the line between the whole, oh, well, it's dark and the characters can't see, so we shouldn't be able to see. The Battle of the Bastards, again, and I'll make this quick, is a very good example of this. John's POV when he is being trampled is very chaotic, and it's very well done. And then they show you that, but then they go back to a crane in an aerial view. Yes. So you should understand, yes, and see that perspective. But the idea of the characters can't see, so you can't see, this is a visual medium for story. It should be established, and then we should be able to witness them struggling.
And that was part of the reason why we got so many wide shots in the beginning and so many wide shots of Winterfell in the two preceding episodes.
I don't think it was terrible, guys. I mean, it wasn't the best. The lighting's not the best in this show. It is what it is.
We don't need to talk about it. Everybody's talking about it. It's tough. So that's not really a hot take on that.
We're all pretty much,
exactly. You know? Exactly. all right. Two questions from Diogo. This episode also raised a few questions. I love this question. Is there still a reason to keep the wall up?
Well, the wall was, well, okay, what was the reason that the wall was built originally, and then what was the reason for it at the beginning of our story?
We're told.
The Wildlings was how they explained it away.
See, that's a great point. We're told that the wall was built to keep out the White Walkers or whatever, the bad things, but it eventually kind of regressed into basically a staging point to stop the Wildlings from coming down, right?
Yes. Yeah.
So... in effect, it obliterated both needs, because supposedly there are no more Wildlings because they're all dead. They're either part of the army or they came with Jon from Hardhome. Jon and Tormund from Hardhome. And the White Walkers are defeated. So it makes you think, I wonder if they're even going to address that. The Night's Watch has played such a big part in the show. It has such a long history. Will it become something new? Maybe the Night's Watch will become a place where they send expeditions past the wall to explore it and to settle it. Maybe we'll even see them talk about settling north of the wall.
I think that we will see that. And I think the Night's Watch will actually be staffed higher, but not for the... in the sense of, we need to stop the Ooga Booga monsters are the people that we're going to decide are barbarians because they're on the other side of that wall. It's because they need to guard the realms of men, meaning all men. They don't need to raise a wall. I mean, this is a story about societal change, reform. This is a story about power and you know, who the best, you know, it's really, you know, it investigates different methods of rule and the philosophy of, ethical rule and what makes a good ruler. It's kind of like a little Machiavellian. So I think that I see the Night's Watch being really, beefed up, but not for the sake of, trying to keep away wildlings or monsters, but for the sake of having people that are always dedicated from all seven kingdoms, technically nine, that are trying to protect this world. So we don't,
but why would they need to protect what?
It should be a standing army is kind of what I'm getting at.
But why would they even be located there? There's the delineation is meaningless anymore. There's nothing that they're not protecting from the wildlings. They're not protecting from the White Walkers. You have to
protect your borders in general. I mean,
but why do they need, but what I'm trying to say is, why does it need to be? I think what the question is really, why does that even need to be a border anymore?
Well, I think that I'm talking about it as an institution, and you're talking about, and I'm going
to
say,
right,
I think
but why would, but I want to ask as you, why would the institution,
as a standing force that always has the realm, whether it is going around by Goldtown in the Vale or whether it's in the Crown Lands.
Oh,
I'm not talking,
oh,
yeah,
okay, not yeah, at I'm the not wall. Okay, that's going, what, yeah, but we're talking about the wall. So do you think that they'll just leave the castles at the wall? They'll just abandon them? I mean, will they? That's. I think that's more the question.
Well, can they build the wall at this point? They
exactly.
can't do.
It'll just remain a relic of another time. They can't take down the rest of it, right?
Yeah, they're not able to do. They haven't had like technological advancement in like 300 years or something, and that's a lot to do with depending on magic. So.
Well, one idea I have is that it becomes an exploration that the people who go to the wall are. Like maybe some different maesters, explorers, adventurers, people who want to go to a new place, and they kind of become they form the Night's Watch becomes, instead of what you said, which I think is a cool idea, they become more of a exploratory, like Star Trek almost. You know what I mean? Like they have a mission of going past the wall and learning and bringing back and understanding. But
yeah.
I don't know if we're going to see that. That would be kind
of
cool, though.
I just think
that'd be
I
a
like
cool
the sentiment
spin-off.
Of not trying to like guard a wall, but the Night's Watch, like the idea of it is to protect the realm, right?
Right.
So
right.
they
From
just
anywhere.
Protect the realm.
Yeah.
All of the realm. Everybody, you know.
That's cool. I like that, man. I like that idea.
Probably won't happen. And people are bringing up that it was served as a prison, they believe. And again, like they don't have the technology to build the wall again. So,
yeah. All right, let's go. Let's move on. We already answered this question, Diago. Did the wildlings lose their purpose to fight now the Night King is defeated? Well, there really aren't that many wildlings left. So I think they're going to have to and they've proven their worth in battle. People have talked about that actually in a couple battles. So I think that, do you think they're going to address that a lot or
what do you mean? Have they lost their, how is that phrase I'm looking for?
Their purpose to fight. I think what he's trying to say is like
against Cersei.
Yeah. That's okay. That's a good point. I'm sorry. I didn't see it.
Yeah,
that
I'm making
way.
A video on that. Right
oh, okay.
Now.
What do you think? So very quickly, we don't want to spoil your big video, Justin. What do you think?
Yeah, well, let's get it out now because it's forever to get out. My thing is that, you know, Dany definitely came and she sacrificed her forces to save the North. Yeah. She has no attachment to the North in every sense. In a lot of, almost every aspect of this, it was very selfless, but also at the same time, it was a little road, you know, block in her journey to get the throne. John was trying to get it to stop. She has sacrificed her power, and she's left with what? Essentially just dragons, which have been the whole time that she's been in Westeros, what has Tyrion especially been trying to get her to stop from doing? Yeah, taking
right.
those to
but King's what does Landing. That have to do with the wildlings? What are you talking about? The wildlings?
We're, I'm talking about how she's going to need other
forces. Oh, okay.
So Dany is going to expect that the people that she helped save go and fight for her. I'm going to say that the strongest person in this realm right now is Sansa, and that the people in the North, even though, because they didn't see season one, they don't have the box set. You know, that's what's great about the story. Like Dany, again, I'm just trying to set it up, did do everything like, you know, she saved the people before she went and tried to take the power, the seat, you know, the mantle. Okay. That's very noble. But also, was that maybe the best plan? Because now all she has is her dragons, which is going to put her in a situation that's going to put her at odds with her council. I think that Sansa has the loyalty of the North. I think that I don't see Sansa going against Dany in a militaristic way, but I see a division. I don't think the people of the North, especially after this heinous battle and this just treachery and all this misery they've just been through, are going to be so eager to march against Cersei Lannister. There's a lot of distance between that capital and them. Yeah. That's not a threat for them right now. You know,
that's it. We talked about this when we were chatting last night about how we might get, there's like kind of a lull where they might, you know, they have to recoup forces. And so
that's next episode. So Dany is going to ask for their allegiance. They are going to be grateful, but I don't see them jumping on horses and starting to go to the capital because Why? Cersei's not going to come to them. You know, we have no reason to believe
and
that.
You could, you could totally even see Tormund say, like, we just did this one battle. We had zombies crawling every, like, let's, you know what I mean? All the people are depleted. That's a good point. All right, let's move
on.
The
last point I want to make, though, really quick, is everybody says Sansa was down in the crypts when they were fighting. This comes back to the whole idea of that, you know, you need to be alive to do good. And Sansa can't, you know, her strengths lie in her intellectual strengths. She has the best education about the politics of these kingdoms. She's been in, you know, the Vale, King's Landing. She's been in the North under three different rulers. She is the one that's actually, even though they don't showcase it well, has, you know, the education from learning from people, from their mistakes and so forth. So all I'm saying is that the people of the North aren't likely to look at Sansa and say, oh, you were just down in the crypts when they were out there fighting. They're just happy to be alive. And I think that we are going to start to learn that, you know, going out, look at Lyanna Mormont, that, you know, she wanted to do good for her people. And she did, you know, get to do the mythic through the giant's eye, but you have to be alive to be for your people. Sansa's not a fighter. Her strengths lie in, you know, other areas, even though they don't like to, you know, show that. That's all I'm saying. So,
no, I agree with you. And that's a great point of the show and something that people should have a greater awareness of is that heroes come in different shapes and forms, and it's not always with the sword and all that. They do different things and people have different roles. All right, let's move on. Thank you so much, Diago from Brazil. That's awesome. Thank you for writing in, and a new listener. That's awesome. I really appreciate that. Ira, too. Fantastic. Now, we got two things, quick things for Brett, and then we're going to get out of here. Brett, you know, hosted the first initial reaction with me. He's going to be with us again. Westworld Theory Cast. Brett's the man. If you like Westworld, check us out. You know, Justin likes Westworld too.
What is that one? Is that with the cowboys?
Never seen it. I don't know if it has cowboys anymore.
It's with the sexy robots.
Sexy robots. Brett says, if Arya successfully trained to become no one while retaining her identity as Arya Stark, is it possible that Bran successfully trained to become the Three-Eyed Raven while retaining his identity as Brandon Stark? When he handed the cat's paw dagger to Arya last season, you could argue that was a means to direct an outcome, not a passive gesture, but an action of a man with a motive. When he convinced Sam to reveal Jon's lineage to him while Sam was in a state of anger toward Daenerys, that could have been an action of a biased man with an opinion, possibly even a Stark looking out for his kin. Whoa, Brett.
Really well written. I like your verbiage.
Brett's the man. I just want to say, I think that this is a wonderful and great new way to look at Bran. Mm-hmm. We see him staring off into space. He tells everybody, I'm not Brandon Stark. I'm not Bran Stark. And yet, you're absolutely right, Brett. Here's two distinct actions that we saw him take that could directly be related to him pushing history or pushing what should happen, and also that come from ego, from himself, right? From Bran Stark. Great point, Brett. What do you think, Justin?
Very beautifully written, and I'm going to disagree, though. Not that there's not validity to
snap
these claims.
Bizzle.
But no, very interesting way to look at it. Now, I'll just start with Arya really quick. Arya was trying to be trained in, you know, in trying to have the, I don't know what you'd call it, ability to forget her past, you know, like the discipline is what I'm looking for. Wow. I like discipline. They were trying to, you know, get her to forget who she was. Now, so you could say that, in a broad sense, they both were trying to become nobody. Bran wasn't trying to become nobody. Bran has absorbed the feelings, the visions. He has been desensitized by the very powers that have.
Okay, you know, I think I know what you're trying to say. Yeah. Arya went through training. Bran had a physical change to his brain and mystical change to his brain. Yeah, so it might
one person was smoking trying to get cancer, and the other person just got it.
Arya trained, but there were mystic arts involved in her training, but it was more of like a Full Metal Jacket type thing, which is we're going to erase you and build you back up.
Yeah.
Whereas Bran went through a metaphysical or physical experience that changed his identity at almost a soul level, right?
Yeah, he became a god, which is essentially a monster in many senses. Because he's otherworldly. He can you know go and see anything.
But you can't deny. But then are you saying though? But look, he was told by the three-eyed raven not to like interfere with stuff. But he gave her that dagger. Then he looked at her and he felt something. I noticed that in the rewatch. And he did like tell Sam go now when he was all angry. And it just does seem and kind of like, you know, I don't know. I think we've got three episodes left, and I think Brett, I'm going to think about this.
Very good point. I just will add to that, that, you know, it's about not interfering with the past, which is the universal rule of time travel. You know, and again,
for you, it is maybe
the paradox, you know, I guess technically he could be in these scenes going back and trying again, when he was like, we don't have time for this, kind of reminded me of somebody that was like at the third playthrough, and didn't get it right. He's like, fuck this conversation.
Hey, wait, hold on, Justin, don't go so fast past what you just said. That was very interesting. What you just said was the times that Bran said, we don't have time for this, we've got to do this, it appeared as if a person who had been through this before and was pushing events in a certain way. Do you think that?
Well, yeah, I mean, that can be, yes, of course, that makes sense. But also, this is a person that is very aware of the threat that has been there, the ticking clock that has been since the beginning. And he is the, other than John, you know, but more than John actually, is very aware. So they don't, I mean, yes, it could be interpreted as that, and there's that connection, correlation, but I don't think that that's, I mean, it's just, you could workshop it that way, but it does make more sense that the green sight gives them the ability to see it in the future a little bit. It's been established that is something that is possible. I don't see him going back in time and messing with things, because that is like the universal thing. Yeah. All I'm saying is that Blood Raven is not Brandon Rivers. You know, and he is, it's like he has embodied what, you know, when he blew up into the dust, you know, what Bran is.
I don't even know what you're talking about.
What?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
But Blood Raven is Brendan Rivers. Okay, he was Hand of the King. He was the Lord Commander for a while. He, you know,
and he became the Three-Eyed Raven, right? Is that what you're talking about? Okay.
Yeah, so like
that. But we're just talking about in the show, you're saying it's a total change. It's a transformation. They become, the Three-Eyed Raven is a static, and they go to that, not the other way around.
Yeah, one's a change in psyche and personality. Yeah. One's a change in your complete agency and like what you are. Like, is it like metaphysically?
Yeah, I get
you
know? It. So, all right, let's move on. Also,
interesting though, Brett, and like the best worded two paragraphs. Well, I've seen in
that's
because
Brett's the man. Also, if the Three-Eyed Raven is the memory of this world, then Bran could have a big role to play if the wheel is going to be broken and a new government formed, so that mankind does not repeat its past mistakes. This is a really interesting idea that I had not thought, Brett. We think so much that Bran can tell them all these secret mythological things, but he can also kind of tell them, hey, they tried this before and it didn't work, or people generally act like this, or you should trust that the people will listen because in the past this happened. I saw it. That's a really interesting point. Have you ever thought of that before, Justin?
Yeah, I think about it all the time of the significance of his ability to see and get perspective, and the idea that he is a man that can see anything but has to still be told where to look. I think that there's a lot of power in that hindsight and that perspective. In this story is all about playing with perspective, and that's how it is. That is the machine that you know, both book and show is about showing both sides of the coin, you know, events through different eyes. And it's very powerful, but at the same time, you know, I had this allegory and I kind of dropped it, but it was like, he is still looking back in time and seeing a whole bunch of people still looking in the flames, you know, trying to figure out the answers for everything. So it's like, there's a lot to be said for people that, you know, if you must remember history or you're bound to repeat it. And that's very much true. But at the same time, you know, we have continued to, you know, do monstrous things over and over again.
But do you think that they'll actually kind of sit Brand down and say, hey man, we're trying to make a government, like what Brett's talking about here, is it really going to happen in the show? Do you think they're going to use him like that?
I don't. Yeah, I don't even know. Though I think that makes sense, because
makes sense.
These are people, again, remember how we started the show? Talking about changing things from the past. So, you know, I'm not saying that's a smart thing, but I'm saying that, you know, nobody's going to see what those old geezers did, except for us with our constitution that we're sticking with. They're like, you guys didn't write anything new. We said 13 years. You know what I mean? But right now, we're sticking with what you guys said there. You guys fuck. But anyways, you know what I mean? I see that as maybe being a tool, but the only thing that that really confuses me, but I don't really have even a just an answer for, is, you know, it seems as though the mantle of the three-eyed raven can't really like live amongst them. So is he going to be sent out into the wilderness? So that, it seems to me, okay, I'm a betting man, so that's what I'll bet will happen. But I agree with Brett and I agree with you that that's what they should do. But I don't, you know, it doesn't seem like they're utilizing him very much.
Scattershot, man, you know?
Yeah.
Like even at that meeting, I thought they were going to be like, hey, by the way, Bran, in the can you go back to every battle that ever was and please tell us all these cool techniques that we could use? But they really didn't do that. All right, let's
move
on.
Why wouldn't they go back to the first pack, the essentially the first pack?
Well,
they
because
they
have
just
to
not utilize it. They're like, ah, we'll figure it
out. Well, because you know why, Justin? Because they're like, Bran, please don't, spoiler alert, we're doing a whole prequel of that and it's coming out in 2020.
Yeah.
Our final
they put time travel in the story, so they're like, oh, fuck, we can't use that.
or it could be a whole new series.
Oh, God.
Our final little bit of feedback. This has been a lot of fun, Justin. I got my energy like picked up about a half hour ago. I kind of woke up. The Lord of Light brought Beric back to ensure that Arya could take down the Night King. The Night King is dead, and so is Beric. The Lord of Light brought Jon back to prepare the battle that took down the Night King. The Night King is dead. I'm nervous for Jon. Mm-hmm. It's an interesting point that when Jon first came back to life, I remember a lot of people saying, maybe this is temporary. And I think he may have even said it in the show at some point. He may have even said something like, I don't know how long I'm here, how much time I have, or something like that. So that's interesting.
Well,
I don't know. What do you think?
Okay, well, I'm going to really disagree with the I get what there's. The Lord of Light brought back Beric to ensure that Arya. Okay, since the gods will never appear in the stories, and this has been stated by George in the Almighty D&D, we cannot say that the Lord of Light. Okay, the Lord of Light brought back Beric six times, and then he did help Arya. The Lord of Light did bring back Jon, and he did play a role in this battle. Okay, to go about it in a way that, you know, there is set plans. I think the point of Beric's character is to show how random it is. He's brought back six times and, you know, I mean, he helped and he did lead.
You're
some
saying
people
there. It's not a direct correlation.
Yeah. So I just want to be careful with that. Of course we should be nervous for Jon, but again, they've done a wonderful job with this with, before the, Battle of the Bastards. Again, they turned something, when you have somebody that's resurrected, that takes stakes away. They're about to go into battle. It's like, oh, he gets killed. Who cares? He'll be resurrected. He asked Melisandre to not bring him back. She says, I'm going to bring you back. And he says, please don't. That's, you know, like really invading my privacy. But all jokes aside, what they did there is they turned a situation where you're looking at a battle that doesn't maybe matter, for like, you know, one of your main protagonists. And they made him being brought back into a negative emotion, you know, so they really play with that well. I am not so much nervous for John dying, because I feel that looking at it in a high concept sense, that the general audience is not going to be thrilled with John dying again. I am willing to bet with everybody here that Tyrion and Dany and Euron are your three people that are going to be dead for sure. Dany and Tyrion are both kind of a bet. One of them for sure, but I would still bet, and I'm looking to bet.
All right.
But
Wait, hold on. Tyrion?
Yes.
Dany and Euron?
Yeah, Euron's a given.
Okay. Okay. So you give me an in. That's who you think's going to die. I forgot last time on feedback to go over Howard's death pool, who we thought was going to die. And I just want to go over it quickly because Howard's awesome. He thought Jorah Mormont, Brienne, Theon, Tormund, Ed, Ghost, Beric, Missandei, and Teela, the little girl. Well, you were not right about Brienne's still alive, Tormund's still alive, Ghost is still alive, and Missandei, and Teela. I think Teela survived. So, unfortunately, Howard, that was not right. You said likely Lyanna Mormont, you were right. Gendry, nope. Podrick, nope. Gilly, nope. Little Sam, nope. So, unfortunately, and you did have everyone else because you said no way, and they didn't die. There weren't a lot of people who died. You think that Dany, Tyrion, and Euron are going to die? I'm never good at this, so I'm not even going to say. I have no idea, and plus we're still doing the Guest of Throne thing. I want to say this, though. My attitude has kind of changed. I really went for about two seasons wanting everybody to die on this show. And I used to say it on the podcast a lot.
Going through a hard time.
Yeah, I don't know why. Because I thought it was kind of fun when people all of a sudden die, you know? And this show was good at it. But now, I don't really care. If everybody lives, everybody lives and they start a new life. If some people die, some people die. What I'm more interested to see in how it happens. So, I like the way Theon died. I like the way Jorah died. I like the way Mormont died. So, I was cool with it. If it's something stupid, I perceive it to be stupid, I don't like it, or unsatisfying, then maybe I'll say so. But
Funeral, I tell people funeral. I'm like, way you died was stupid.
Well, listen, dude, I'm Irish. At Irish funerals, we tell jokes and get drunk. We don't cry.
Yeah, well, because everybody's like a day away from their funeral. Can I state a short case for? I would just think to keep the coffin. You know what I mean? You're just going to need to use that again. But anyways, Dany is far more likely to die than John, because think of the situation. If John dies, Dany, her quest has been for the throne. John's quest has essentially been for, yes, recognition and all that, but now it's kind of just for peace.
Yes.
If John were to die, that would be hard for Dany because of the relationship, but also she still gets her throne. So if Dany dies, he does not want to sit on that throne, but he is going to be forced into that throne. So that is far more conflict. Tyrion is being pulled in three different directions. Sansa, Dany, and Cersei, his family. So I see he has so many.
Oh, we're losing you there, buddy. I think Justin is out. We made it all the way to the end. It was a fantastic event we had here on the YouTube.
No more dancing around in season 7. They only got the dragons.
He's back. He's back. We lost you there for a second there, bud.
Yeah, all I'm saying is that the Tyrion's got a lot of different angles that are tugging at him.
He's been so sad this season too. Like, you're right, dude. It's like, it's almost as if he's got something on his mind that's just, I don't know. Now, before we go, because I got to get going, it's getting late here. I just want to ask you, we're talking about people dying. I don't usually talk about it or predict it, but I want to ask you, do you think Cersei's going to die? Do you think she's going to live? Do you think she's going to win? Do you think she's going to get blow things up? Because that's what I think. What do you think is going to happen?
Yeah, I think that she will be the one that turns the Golden Company on King's Landing. They will not break their contract because they will do what she asks. And that is, if you know she can't have the throne, then nobody can have it. But I would bet Cersei has a better chance of living than Dany.
Oh, all right. Let's leave it at that. Leave it at that, Justin. Justin, thank you so much for being on with me this evening, brother. Can you please tell everyone again where they can find you?
They can find me at Top Shelf Fandom, and you know, we're putting out videos, and we have some really good streams coming this Sunday. We got the return of Before the Dust Settles, a little Game of Thrones special edition with me and the co-host Hex Dogma. I consider you became pretty much part of the official structure, but W. Axel Foley will be with us, Robert from In Deep Geek, and Johnny B. Crazy. And then on Monday, a day after the episode, because there's so many streams now that it's like I have to like do it at 4 o'clock in the morning to get a slot. But I got two excellent content creators, Keen McKay, who's in New Zealand. So 16 hours ahead, we're doing it at 11 p.m. Eastern on Monday night. And also my Australian buddy. So I'm going all South Pacific on it. You know what I mean? So we were going to do that. And it's going to be a lot of fun. And I'm going to try to keep these going. And I think that this blockbuster movie, because that's what we got coming, three acts, baby. And, you know, this is very much uniform. And it's going to be jostling for power, and it's going to remind us of season one, and it's going to be great. I'm really excited, and make sure to subscribe, make sure to check me out on Patreon. It would mean the world if you help me create content. $3 from you would hopefully be barely noticeable, and it makes a huge difference for me to be able to afford Adobe in editing programs. I don't spend it on fancy vacations or anything like that.
It'd be fine if you did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because that'd be fine if you did.
Eventually,
baby.
Yeah, all right, man. Thank you for having me on, Axel. So it's been a heck of a time. You know,
it's fun. I was just like, the kid was going to sleep. I could see it happening. I said, "Hey, Justin, you want to do this?" And now it's done. We had a great time talking about Game of Thrones. I want to give it a throwback here, and I want to thank Brett. I want to thank Diago. I want to thank, John Lee. I want to thank John Wambacher. I want to thank Ira. And I want to thank the Velvet Days, all people who contributed to this feedback episode and who made it happen. You can email
also
us.
Also the chat. I just
want yes.
I don't want to interrupt. Forget. I just know you don't have it.
No, that's fine. So, thank you, everyone in the chat. You know what? Before we go, you're right. I'm ignoring that we're on YouTube. You tell me this. You're like, Axel, don't just do a podcast on YouTube. Actually, like, talk to the people on YouTube. Do you want to answer some things do you want to look in the chat? Did anybody have anything you want to talk about?
I can say what's up.
I can give it a few more minutes here.
But
let me just tell you, let me just say this,
Amanda
Justin.
Kane.
People in the chat, if you are in the chat or if you're listening, you too can email us at podcastwinterfell@gmail.com because I always like to hear from everybody. So go ahead, Justin.
Yeah, absolutely. We've got, maybe some of these are coming from the podcast side, but I recognize a lot of these people. OTDA, thank you for stopping by. We got Scott 2T248. Let's see what he says about the Night King. I think the Night King story is gone now. Everything does not need to be answered. Leaves us talking after. Yes, Scott, if you're still here, that is my sentiment completely. And it's natural for us to want more. And it was a little bit hasty, but at the same time, the arc is technically complete. And we, you can only, it's like, you know, just, you're just prolonging what's going to happen no matter what. So, I like that sentiment, and I think that we'll all come around to it.
Yeah. I think that if the Night King's over and there's no more of that kind of magic or figuring it out, or if it's only just with, you know, whatever Bran might have to do or nothing, or I just have to go away and be in the woods, I'm okay with that. I'm okay with the rest of the story being about the people that we know, Cersei, what happens after, even if they jump forward. That's been, a lot of people are talking about that. I think you might have said that.
To get that baby, we got to,
you know? Yeah, you jump, or even farther forward, dude, like 20 years or something. That could be kind of fun, but we are
also the magic, too. I just want to touch on what you said. Just because and I'm sorry to interrupt, I just like that aspect. Remember that the magic doesn't die with them. They become strong because of the magic. So we most likely will see a drop in the magic. We've seen it with our arc. We've seen the high aspect of it. But remember, magic's what's made them possible. We don't know why the rhyme or reason, but you know, that's why it's not like it's impossible for this to happen again. And again, we don't know what happens with the White Walker babies. I don't know which kindergarten they're in. It's hard to get in a good school.
Well, that's, you know, somebody said this, I saw this question on Twitter. what happens if they left some of the younger White Walkers back at White Walker camp? Did they explode into ice too? Did it happen everywhere?
Yeah, that was Aziz, and I had a question for him that I actually I brought up the fact that they have a language, which means they have wants and needs, but also they create art with the symbols.
But you know, that's a lot of people. That's troll art. They're it's the upside down flag. They're inverting.
Primordial, you know? Spiral. The point is, them creating patterns, art, anything is usually akin to why we have societal institutions. It means we create art usually to try to interpret our meaning, our find meaning. So my question to them was, what the Night King had his, you know, the White Walkers had their goal to get, you know, Bran, because most likely I just elate that too, because he's a green seer. So were they trying to fulfill their meaning, or were they trying to find meaning in this? Because, you know, just that was my question. So, I mean, that's for another time, but that I was very intrigued by that as well. Get back to me, Aziz. No, Aziz is a really good guy. So yeah, let's go through this chat really quick. We, Amanda Kane, one of my lovely, curators. Thank you so much. Tim Hines, I believe you know
DJ,
Tim.
Wait a second. Hold on. I always, whenever DJ Tim is around, I don't read his emails. And so I'm going to just read something he said in the chat. Just because it's DJ Tim Hines. And he said, I need an intern. Okay. DJ has now contributed to the podcast and the live stream. All right. Anything else, Justin? Thanks everyone in the chat.
Yeah, I also need interns. Bad. I really do. If anybody is like an organized person that likes working with creative stuff, but like is able to smack somebody's hand when they go off on a tangent,
you got to do what I do. You have to have a wife and have a child, and then you just wait until that child's like 13, and then you can tell them they can do all those kind of tasks for you.
No, that's not worth it at all. Oh my God, that's...
Are you kidding me? Let me tell you something right now. Live on a podcast, my son is the joy of my life, people. He is the most wonderful thing that ever happened to me. And we're going to end it there. I think we're good with the chat. I got to get going. We've been doing this almost 2 hours. Thank you, everyone who's been in the chat. Thank you, Justin.
Fandom D. Saint and everybody else.
Fandom D. Saint. We're going to be going, DJ's going to do a little YouTube thing on Monday. We're going to have a smaller crowd, I think 3 or 4 people. Actually, I think John Wambacher is going to be a part of that. And we'll be releasing that to subscribe, rate, all that kind of stuff. Again, email us at podcastwinterfell@gmail.com if you would like. And Justin, I will just let you say goodbye, because I don't like to not let you say goodbye again.
Yeah, I don't like how you left it off as like the idea that I should have kids. Axel is happy with his situation. I'm happy with mine. Kids will not answer your problems. They're just a drain on your checking account.
That's all
I'm saying, though. But he has a lovely family. I'm not a good person.
Maybe so a drain on your checking account, but they add to the bank account of love.
Yeah, it's not a half glass half full, half empty. You're just happy to have that glass, aren't you? All right. No, there's something beautiful about it. So thank you guys so much. And there's something beautiful about a Game of Thrones.
Yes.
It's almost like a song of ice and fire. So thank you guys so much. Make sure to subscribe. It's already over 100. You get a vanity URL, man. Let's put this off air right now. Thank you guys so much.
Get a vanity. I'm going to get my vanity URL. Peace out, everybody.
Spoiler alert. When this podcast talks about the television series Game of Thrones, it talks in the context of the most recently aired episode. You've been warned.
Clef Notes, an analysis of the music in HBO's Game of Thrones.
Lots of people are still talking about the music from Season 8, Episode 3, and it feels like we need to have a deeper conversation about the piece written by Ramin for that particular episode entitled The Night King. You can find it on Spotify. You can find it on Amazon. I've included a link in the show notes in case you want to purchase it or just listen to it for free like most people do on Spotify. We musicians aren't a big fan of streaming. Anyway, the whole idea behind this theme and the emotions that it carries throughout the entirety of the piece, which is well over 8 minutes, not quite as long as Light of the Seven, which was a little over 9 minutes, has some fascinating aspects to it. And we're going to be looking at that. But before we do, This podcast you will hear on Matt's audio blog at mattsaudioblog.com if you want to check that podcast out. And I'm also, because I started Podcast Winterfell basically on the premise of checking out the music of the show, more so than knowing anything about the story at the time, I'm going to hand this over to Axel at the DVR Podcast Network as well, in case he wants to put it on there so that Podcast Winterfell gets at least one other musical contribution this season. That's up to those guys. They may do it, they may not. And I totally respect if they're doing so many podcasts a week, they probably don't have time to stick mine in anywhere. Maybe not till after the season's over, but maybe they will. We'll see. In the meantime, do support those guys. If you don't listen to Podcast Winterfell already, please listen to Podcast Winterfell. You can go to podcastwinterfell.com to find out all kinds of stuff. More importantly, you can go to dvrpodcast.com where you can find the whole network of shows that Axel and gang are doing over there. A lot of great television shows being covered. There's information about their Patreon page, which allows you to get their podcast ad-free, and all kinds of neat information. So be sure to follow at Winterfell Pod on Twitter. Be sure to check out dvrpodcast.com or podcastwinterfell.com. And I'll put all those links in the show notes as well. But let's get to talking about this particular piece of music in this special Clef Notes edition. And that's just a small snippet of the piece. This is the part that we kind of looked at when we talked about it in the Thursday edition of my show, Matt's Audio Blog. The whole idea, that motive, that piano note there, was actually set up very well throughout the episode, done with more orchestrated versions. Anytime we had the Night King around, we heard that particular kind of little melody notes being played by various instruments to kind of, I guess, accentuate the nefariousness of the presence of the Night King and the Whites in general. But when you look at the theme itself, overall, throughout the whole 8 minutes, it's actually just one small part. This part that I covered is actually just one small part of the overall thematic material within the piece, as well as the overall narrative and the way that Ramin uses different kinds of devices to accentuate the tension or to accentuate the emotion. There are some really beautiful things being done here. I'm not a fan of the dressing, but as a function, as the piece functions, I think it was done very well. And that's the part we're going to be looking at today. First of all, we do have this motive, which I just played. This is one part of the thematic material within the piece itself, this part right here. And again, that doesn't seem like a very big motive or something to be important, really, in terms of the overall piece, because there are other things that distract our attention within the piece. But this is the central part that was evident through the whole episode. The other parts of this melody we really didn't hear that much of in the rest of the episode. In fact, I couldn't even find a reference to this second part that we're going to cover. The first part that I just played there was present in several cases throughout the episode. That and the Lord of Light seemed to be the two main things. You had the Night King side, you had the Lord of Light side. That was pretty much the musical narrative. There were things like the Faceless Man theme, which we heard in Arya music when she was fighting when Melisandre first saw Arya. We heard the parts of the Faceless Man theme. Again, those were done very well, but this is just going to concentrate mainly on the Ninth King, which is the piece that Ramin released. And it's an excellent piece in terms of the way it functions and tells the story of this musical montage. That little motive there that I've been playing is, again, the thing that makes it seem familiar to you by the time you get to this rather different presentation from the way that we've heard it all throughout the whole rest of the episode. So it helps you recognize it, but it also helps you to see how this particular thing stands out, which was the intention of Miguel Schnepozdyk and Dave and Dan and Ramin. Schnepozdyk said, we were breaking all of the rules in this episode, starting with the music. And really, wasn't breaking the rules because Ramin had already done that with The Light of the Seven. But I understand Miguel's enthusiasm for the fact that this part of the episode musically doesn't sound like any other part in the episode. And that's nice. So that main little motive right there is the way that we recognize that we've heard it before and the way that we recognize how different we're now hearing it. But there's another part that is integral, and I think that this is the part that probably got most people's blood boiling, the part that really got people excited about the music. It's this motive right here. I'm going to play it from the clip. Now, that is the bare bones melody of that second part. And the reason I say that this is what gets our blood pumping, and not in a bad way, I mean in a good way, the thing that gets our blood pumping is the sense of movement. Because that first motive that we played just has this kind of stagnant bouncing back and forth. And it does have the little bit of slipping of key. It feels like a slipping of key when that second note in some places with the Night King seems to go lower than the first note. Like it starts at the same note, but then it dips lower than it does the second note. That's the first part. Here we have this where the melody is actually moving and the chords underneath are changing rather than just being under kind of one long stagnant sense of harmony. Now, functionally, there's some really interesting things happening here. For one, this melody is still pretty sparse. It's a little less sparse than that first motive that Ramin had been using throughout the whole episode, but it's still sparse, and it allows him to have space within the whole piece to build those spaces. He can fill in with string lines or with arpeggios or with all kinds of things that he can use to heighten our emotion as really what we're seeing on the screen gets even more intense. That's the purpose of music. But I love how if you just look at the logistics of the way that this whole thing is built, that it does actually work like a conversation. And all good music does. A symphony, a good jazz solo, all to me, and this is personal taste, but all to me, good music starts as a conversation. And if I walk up to a complete stranger and I say, have you considered the intricacies of the Pythagorean theorem? Chances are they're going to look at me like I'm crazy, right? No. You walk up to somebody and you introduce yourself. Hello, how are you doing? And that's the way this piece builds. In the same way that the intensity and the action and the surprise and all of the drama of the shoot feels. You know, the scenes that we're seeing. We've got John, he's got his own thing going on with Viserion. We've got all of our characters struggling near death. We've got the Night King just, you know, staring Theon in the face and Bran getting ready to send Theon to his death. And, you know, what's going to happen? Is all of humanity going to die? This piece is minor. And what does minor mean? Minor typically means sad or scary. And in this case, it's both. Right up until the time where we see Arya actually stab the Night King. And that's actually after the end of this whole piece of music is over. The music ends with the Night King holding Arya by the neck. That's where the music ends. So this is all a buildup of the complete tension. And then we get resolution after that in other scoring. So we don't have here. So I love that this is a conversation. It's like, there was this guy. And he had all the memory in the world. And there was this other guy. And he wanted to eliminate all the memory of the world. Nothing about, you know, the whole aspect of, well, the Night King was created by blah, 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 and blah, 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 blah. We don't need that. What we need is the emotion of the Night King in the courtyard. There he is. That's all. That's a simple conversation. And that's the way this thing starts. And it starts with the simplest of motives and then builds to this motive that I just played. When we really get invested in this part of the melody that I've been talking about for the last few seconds is when all of the dressing happens. And again, this is a great, functionally fantastic piece in the fact that the tension is built by the addition of instruments, by the addition of counterlines, by the addition of the distance of notes that the arpeggios travel. Let's look at that real quick. Here's the most climactic part of that melody we've been talking about right here. By repeating notes, he increases the tension. Da, 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 da. Instead of just da, 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 you get da, 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 the staccato, the performance, the way that everything is separated. There's something about that kind of performance. And of course, Ramin was expecting this from his players. This is what musicians do. But there is something within the performance of staccato notes, of repetitious notes, where you normally had just one long note being held out. Now you've got all these little short notes, but it's the same pitch, creates extra tension. On top of that, underneath, the strings are doing this arpeggio. And if you listen from the beginning to the end, it sounds like, okay, well, the arpeggios are within a certain range here at the beginning. But then the range gets bigger. And this is what, when we talk about the intervals or the shape of things, makes a play on you psychologically. Now it's getting so big, it seems so imminent. And really, I lied. This isn't even the climax of the entire piece, because what are you going to do when your strings are going from as low as they can go in the cellos to as high as they can go in the violins? Where do you build it from there? You change up the rhythm. Ever since I started Matt's audio blog, and a long time before that in Podcast Winterfell, I've attributed the fact that psychoacoustics, which is the way that sounds make us feel, goes all the way back to Pythagoras. I use Pythagoras a lot. He studied why major chords or why certain sequences of notes make us feel happy, make us feel sad. And it's been used for 2,000 years, longer, 5,000 years. I don't know. When was Pythagoras alive? Anyway, it's been that long. And the human response never changes. And Ramin knows this. Was he taught this? Does he do it instinctively? Does it matter? No. He just knows that certain things make us shift gears emotionally. And again, I am not a fan of the dressing of this piece. I felt like it was a recreation of The Light of the Seven, right down to this part that we're about to get into. But I do want to emphasize that there is no way functionally that I can criticize this piece from a functional aspect in terms of making it a conversation, making it start, making it evolve, and making our emotions evolve with it. This is all done from a functionally superior standpoint. So let me make that perfectly clear. While I am not a fan of the dressing of this, and by that I mean the way that it kind of followed suit with Light of the Seven in a lot of ways, from instrumentation to the development to everything else, I cannot, simply cannot complain with the way that functionally and emotionally it makes a person feel. It's a textbook example of what a film score should be in terms of function. But that brings us to my last question, which was, we're already so big. All the arpeggios of the strings are going every which direction. You can't get bigger. The whole idea of shape has made this huge. The idea of harmony has told us how to feel. Those are two of the three things that I always look for in film scoring. What's the third? Timbre. That one I'm just kind of okay on. But there's that fourth aspect that rarely gets mentioned, even by me. And that's important. If you have all of this going on a straight, if you're going 1, 2, 3, 4, dot, 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 how do you make that feel more complex and more tense? You do it by doing this. 1, 2, 3, 4, da 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 da. All of a sudden, the notes seem out of place. Everything seems more intense, and that's exactly what Ramin does here. It's like double the intensity, although it's really just 3/2 of the intensity from a math standpoint. By the way, in case you didn't know, music is really just math. You've probably figured that out already. But it definitely, changing the rhythm up, makes our heart beat faster. Oh my gosh, our heart is beating faster. And then Ramin does even something more intense. He takes these triplet rhythms and he groups them in fours, which goes against the meter and creates additional tension like this. Your mind is blown and you don't even know why. I mean, I know why, because I've been doing this for a long time and I recognize these things when I hear them. But for a person who's just, I don't know, watching Avengers Endgame or who's watching Star Wars or who's watching whatever, all of these functional tricks blended with the emotion of picture made me fist pump when Arya showed up. Everything had been building up. And the whole time I was watching this sequence, I was kind of like, oh, man, he's doing it again. But by the time Arya was flying through the air, I was into it. Even me, the biggest critic of The Light of the Seven, the biggest critic of this piece, I guarantee you I am. But functionally, it did exactly what it was supposed to. So how can you argue with that? There's no reason to. Beautifully done. And those are the two main thrusts of the original stuff. There are other sections within because it's a very long piece. And what we call that is variation. Let's go back to the whole idea of the da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Not only did Ramin develop rhythm in that section, he also started to take the chord progression itself and change it a little bit. So he's doing a variation on the harmony. And he made the melody fit it and changed the melody a little bit. We call that variation on melody. This part. That's wonderful. Now the melody is going somewhere else. Just the way a conversation starts off simple, you get on to a subject, you get deeper into the subject, sometimes the subject changes a little bit. That's what a variation is. Again, Ramin, functionally and conversationally, did a brilliant job with this piece. And I love that part of it. There was one other section that just seemed transitional so that he could get from one aspect of what he was doing to the other aspect with a lot of kind of interesting little chords that just kind of transition from one section to the next of the piece. Not so much to talk about that, because I think you'll hear it, you'll recognize it. It's just being some chords. What I did love about those was the what we call the color of the chords, the way the chords were constructed, what kind of notes, what arrangement those notes were in, made for some very interesting sonic principles. It's probably most people's least favorite part because it doesn't seem like it makes a whole lot of sense. To me, that's the stuff that's really interesting. And if you really like it too, hey, man, thanks. Welcome to the Sonic train. If you don't, I totally understand. So I'm not going to cover that here. The one last aspect of this that I am going to cover is the use of the main theme motive. This. Heard it 3 billion times. We've all heard it 3 billion times because God knows how many times we've watched these episodes, right? Especially during the long hiatus. We probably watched the whole series like 3 or 4 times, or at least I did. And so this motive is so present in so many episodes. And of course, it's present in every episode if you watch the credits at the beginning, which you should. You should always watch the credits at the beginning. Anyway, that motive right there is developed beautifully in a certain section as well, this section. Love it, love it. Probably my favorite part. Nah, not really. I don't know what my favorite part was. I do love it as an overall piece in terms of achieving its function. And with that, I think there's really not much else that I really want to address about this piece. I hope you've enjoyed this conversation with me. If you have any thoughts yourself, feel free to submit them to me at Matt's GOT blog on Twitter. Or if you want to pass it along to Podcast Winterfell, if they're going to cover this, again, they're so busy. I don't know when this might come up or if ever it will come up. But if it does, and you want to talk to Axel or Heath or Mike or Tracy or DJ Tim Hines about this, feel free to hit them up. I think their email is podcastwinterfell@gmail.com. You can always find them at the DVR Podcast Network. That's dvrpodcast.com. You can find me at mattsaudioblog.com. I want to say this too. I've spent a lot of time making fun of people who do theories. That's just kind of who I am. It would be remiss of me to not make fun of myself. On Podcast Winterfell, I put up a musical predictions thing. I put it out on mine as well. And we had the big Theon death this week. And I had predicted a big version of the Greyjoy theme for Theon's heroic death regarding trying to save Yara. Well, I was wrong on every aspect of that, right? We did get a little bit of the Greyjoy theme when he cut her ropes. That was about it. That was a nice version, but it wasn't nearly the happy, resolved theme that I had predicted that we would have like we did at the end of season 7. I love the Greyjoy theme. What is dead will never die. And what Ramin did with that at the end of season 7, I guess it just can't ever be topped in my head. But just to qualify here, because I'll be the first to make fun of Axel or DJ or any of those guys for their crazy theories that they're just having fun with. I understand that. I'm just too serious. I need empirical evidence before I can say anything. But even when I feel like I have empirical evidence, I am often wrong. So feel free to drop me a line at MatchGOTBlog on Twitter. Just laugh at me. That's okay. Take care, all. Bye-bye.